excerpt from Arena One, Slave Runners by Morgan Rice. I slowly open Bree's door. The second I do, Sasha charges in and rushes to Bree's side, lying down and resting her chin on Bree's chest as she licks her face. It never ceases to amaze me how close those two are. Sometimes I feel like they are even closer than we are. Bree slowly opens her eyes and squints into the darkness.
Brooke?
She asks. It's me, I say softly. I'm home. She sits up and smiles as her eyes light up with recognition. She lies on a cheap mattress on the floor and throws off her thin blanket and begins to get out of bed, still in her pajamas. She is moving more slowly than usual. I lean down and give her a hug. I have a surprise for you, I say, barely able to contain my excitement. She looks up, wide-eyed, then closes her eyes and opens her hands, waiting. She is so believing, so trusting. It amazes me. I debate what to give her first, then settle on the chocolate. I reach into my pocket, pull out the bar, and slowly place it in her palm. She opens her eyes and looks down at her hand, squinting in the light, unsure. I hold the candle up to it.
What is it?
She asks. Chocolate, I answer. She looks up as if I'm playing a trick on her. Really? I say.
But where did you get it?
She asks, uncomprehending. She looks down as if an asteroid has just landed in her hand. I don't blame her. There are no stores anymore, no people around, and no place within 100 miles of here where I could conceivably find such a thing. I smile down at her. Santa gave it to me, for you. It's an early Christmas present. She wrinkles her brows.
No, really,
she insists. I take a deep breath, realizing it's time to tell her about our new home, about leaving here tomorrow. I try to figure the best way to phrase it. I hope she will be as excited as I am, but with kids you never know. A part of me worries she might be attached to this place and not want to leave. Bree, I have some big news, I say, as I lean down and hold her shoulders. I discovered the most amazing place today, high up. It's a small stone cottage, and it's perfect for us. It's cozy and warm and safe, and it has the most beautiful fireplace, which we can light every night. And best of all, it has all kinds of food right there, like this chocolate. Bree looks back down at the chocolate, studying it, and her eyes open twice as wide as she realizes it's real. She gently pulls back the wrapper and smells it. She closes her eyes and smiles, then leans in to take a bite, but suddenly stops herself. She looks up at me in concern.
What about you? She asks. Is there only one bar?
That's Bree, always so considerate, even if she's starving. You go first, I say. It's okay. An excerpt from Another Bad Dog Book by Joni B. Cole. Not another one. I had gone to the bookstore to read the gossip magazines for free when I saw it. Yet another best-selling book about someone's adorable, out-of-control dog. Usually these types of bad dog stories center around a yellow lab or similar large loping breed, though the subject of this newest memoir was, according to the title, A Very Bad Beagle. The description on the back cover read pretty much the same as all those other bad dog books that fly off the shelves. The doggy main character was an exuberant, incorrigible scamp with a habit of overturning houseplants, eating table legs, and making madcap dashes through restaurants, offices, and other public venues, all while teaching its owners life lessons like the value of commitment and what it really means to be a family. The Very Bad Beagle's mischievous eyes looked up at me from dozens of display copies, all hogging the most precious of real estate in the bookstore, the new release table at the entrance. Just seeing that cute face and those floppy ears, on a hardcover no less, aroused all of my considerable professional jealousy and frustration. My new release should have been the one on that front table. That is, if I had bothered to write a new release. Unfortunately, my career as an author had not been going so well, at least not since I had discovered the Watch Instantly option on Netflix. In this heartwarming and hilarious memoir, I began reading aloud from the cover copy, my voice dripping with disdain. I'll be in the music section. My daughter, who had come to the bookstore with me to kill a rainy afternoon, quickly made her escape. This wasn't the first time she'd heard me rant about dog books. I returned the bad beagle to the table, face down, as a form of protest. Of course, the store showcased other equally predictable instant bestsellers. Yet another vampire book, another paean to Jane Austen, another celebrity autobiography penned by a ghostwriter. Oddly enough, I felt no resentment toward these types of books, maybe because they seemed so far removed from my own realm of interest and ambitions. An excerpt from Verbs, Verbs, Verbs by Marvin Turbin. Kinds of verbs. What is a verb? A verb is a word that shows or expresses action, being, or doing. From the moment you woke up this morning to right now, you've used hundreds of verbs. You've spoken them, read them, heard them, and written them. You couldn't communicate with people without verbs. You couldn't even talk to a dog without them. Sit, jump, fetch. Every sentence must have a verb. What is a sentence? Here's the world's best definition of a sentence. A sentence is a group of words that contains a subject and a verb, and that makes complete sense. No verb, no sentence. A sentence could be as short as one word, but that one word has to be a verb. Stop is a sentence because the word stop is a verb. Most verbs show action. Jennifer leaped over the snoozing elephant. David will jog all the way to Walla Walla. But action doesn't always mean fast-moving, energetic, vigorous, forceful, action-packed action, like running, throwing, or jumping. Phew, that last sentence was so full of action, it was exhausting. An excerpt from The Scarlet Letter by Nathaniel Hawthorne.
"Good wives," said a hard-featured dame of 50. "I'll tell ye a piece of my mind. It would be greatly for the public behoof if we women, being of mature age and church members in good repute, should have the handling of such malefactresses as this Hester Prynne. What think ye, gossips? If the hussy stood up for judgment before us five, that are now here in a knot together, would she come off with such a sentence as the worshipful magistrates have awarded? Marry, I trow not."
"People say," said another, "that the Reverend Master Dimmesdale, her godly pastor, takes it very grievously to heart that such a scandal should have come upon his congregation."
"The magistrates are God-fearing gentlemen, but merciful overmuch. That is a truth," added a third autumnal matron. "At the very least, they should have put the brand of a hot iron on Hester Prynne's forehead. Madam Hester would have winced at that, I warrant me. But she, the naughty baggage, little will she care what they put upon the bodice of her gown. Why, look you, she may cover it with a brooch or such like heathenish adornment, and so walk the streets as brave as ever."
"Ah, but,"
interposed more softly, a young wife holding a child by the hand,
"let her cover the mark as she will. The pang of it will be always in her heart."
"What do we talk of marks and brands, whether on the bodice of her gown or the flesh of her forehead?" cried another female,
the ugliest as well as the most pitiless of these self-constituted judges.
"This woman has brought shame upon us all, and ought to die. Is there not law for it? Truly there is, both in the scripture and the statute book. Then let the magistrates, who have made it of no effect, thank themselves if their own wives and daughters go astray."
"Mercy on us, good wife," exclaimed a man in the crowd. "Is there no virtue in woman save what springs from a wholesome fear of the gallows? That is the hardest word yet. Hush now, gossips, for the lock is turning in the prison door, and here comes Mistress Prynne herself."
The door of the jail being flung open from within, there appeared in the first place, like a black shadow emerging into the sunshine, the grim and grisly presence of the town beadle, with a sword by his side and his staff of office in his hand. This personage prefigured and represented in his aspect the whole dismal severity of the Puritanic code of law, which it was his business to administer in its final and closest application to the offender. Stretching forth the official staff in his left hand, he laid his right upon the shoulder of a young woman, whom he thus drew forward. Until, on the threshold of the prison door, she repelled him by an action marked with natural dignity and force of character, and stepped into the open air as if by her own free will. She bore in her arms a child, a baby of some 3 months old, who winked and turned aside its little face from the too vivid light of day, because its existence heretofore had brought it acquainted only with the gray twilight of a dungeon or other darksome apartment of the prison. When the young woman, the mother of this child, stood fully revealed before the crowd, it seemed to be her first impulse to clasp the infant closely to her bosom, not so much by an impulse of motherly affection as that she might thereby conceal a certain token which was wrought or fastened into her dress. In a moment, however, wisely judging that one token of her shame would but poorly serve to hide another, she took the baby on her arm, and, with a burning blush, and yet a haughty smile, and a glance that would not be abashed, looked around at her townspeople and neighbors. On the breast of her gown, in fine red cloth, surrounded with an elaborate embroidery and fantastic flourishes of gold thread, appeared the letter A. It was so artistically done, and with so much fertility and gorgeous luxuriance of fancy, that it had all the effect of a last and fitting decoration to the apparel which she wore, and which was of a splendor in accordance with the taste of the age, but greatly beyond what was allowed by the sumptuary regulations of the colony. An excerpt from Little Women by Louisa May Alcott.
"Christmas won't be Christmas without any present," grumbled Joe, lying on the rug.
"It's so dreadful to be poor," sighed Meg, looking down at her old dress.
"I don't think it's fair for some girls to have plenty of pretty things, and other girls nothing at all,"
added little Amy, with an injured sniff.
"We've got father and mother and each other,"
said Beth contentedly from her corner. The four young faces on which the firelight shone brightened at the cheerful words, but darkened again, as Joe said sadly,
"We haven't got father, and shall not have him for a long time."
She didn't say, "Perhaps never," but each silently added it, thinking of father far away where the fighting was. Nobody spoke for a minute. Then Meg said in an altered tone,
"You know the reason Mother proposed not having any presents this Christmas was because it is going to be a hard winter for everyone, and she thinks we ought not to spend money for pleasure when our men are suffering so in the army. We can't do much, but we can make our little sacrifices and ought to do it gladly, but I am afraid I don't."
And Meg shook her head as she thought regretfully of all the pretty things she wanted.
"But I don't think the little we should spend would do any good. We've each got a dollar, and the army wouldn't be much help by our giving that. I agree not to expect anything from Mother or you, but I do want to buy Undine and Sintram for myself. I've wanted it so long," said Joe, who was a bookworm.
"I have planned to spend mine in new music," said Beth, with a little sigh, which no one heard but the hearth brush and kettle holder.
"I shall get a nice box of Faber's drawing pencils. I really need them," said Amy decidedly. "Mother didn't say anything about our money, and she won't wish us to give up everything. Let's each buy what we want and have a little fun. I'm sure we work hard enough to earn it," cried Joe, examining the heels of her shoes in a gentlemanly manner.
"I know I do. Teaching those tiresome children nearly all day when I long to enjoy myself at home,"
began Meg, in the complaining tone again.
"You don't have half such a hard time as I do," said Joe. "How would you like to be shut up for hours with a nervous, fussy old lady who keeps you trotting, is never satisfied, and worries you till you're ready to fly out of the window or cry?"
"It's naughty to fret, but I do think washing dishes and keeping things tidy is the worst work in the world. It makes me cross, and my hands get so stiff, I can't practice well at all."
And Beth looked at her rough hands with a sigh that anyone could hear that time.
I don't believe any of you suffer as I do," cried Amy. "For you don't have to go to school with impertinent girls who plague you if you don't know your lessons and laugh at your dresses and label your father if he isn't rich and insult you when your nose isn't nice."
"If you mean libel, I'd say so, and not talk about labels as if Papa was a pickle bottle," advised Joe, laughing.
"I know what I mean, and you needn't be satirical about it. It's proper to use good words and improve your vocabulary,"
returned Amy with dignity.
"Don't peck at one another, children," said Meg.
An excerpt from The Scientific American Brave New Brain by Judith Horstman. Scientists are finding one of the ways your brain changes itself is by actually changing your genes, or more correctly, by the acting out, or not, of certain genes in the process of epigenesis. We know that your genome is the total deoxyribonucleic acid, DNA, that you inherit from your ancestors and contains the instructions for making your unique body and brain. Another layer of information, called the epigenome, is stored in the proteins and chemicals that surround and stick to the DNA. It's a kind of chemical switch that determines which genes are activated or not. It tells your genes what to do and where and when. Researchers have discovered that the epigenome can be affected by many things, from aging and diet to environmental toxins to even what you think and feel. This means that even your experiences can literally change your mind by chemically coding the DNA that controls a function. The coding doesn't alter the underlying genetic code. Rather, it alters specific gene expression, shutting down or revving up the production of proteins that affect your mental state. Epigenetics helps explain the gap between nature and nurture that has long puzzled scientists. Why some illnesses and traits pop up in one, but not both, identical twins who have the same DNA, or why these traits skip a generation. It also helps explain neuroplasticity,